Chapter 2 The Oregon sat alongside a pier in Reykjavik, Iceland, tied fast to the bollards. The vessels in port were a mishmash of both workboats and pleasure crafts, fishing boats and factory trawlers, smaller cruisers, and, unusual for Iceland, a few large yachts. The fishing boats supported Iceland's largest industry. The yachts were here because the Arab Peace Summit was currently in session. The Oregon would never win any beauty contests. The 500-plus-foot-long cargo steamer appeared to be held together mostly by rust. Her upper decks were littered with junk. Her upper and lower hull were a cacophony of mismatched paint, and the derrick amidships looked as if it might tumble into the water at any moment. But the Oregon's appearance was all an illusion. The rust was carefully applied radar-absorbing paint that allowed her to slip off radar screens like a wraith. The junk on the decks, only props. The derricks worked fine. A couple operated as intended. A few were communication antenna. And the rest flipped away to reveal missile firing pods. Below decks, her accommodations rivaled the finest yachts. Opulent staterooms, a state-of-the-art communications and command center, a helicopter, shore boats, and a complete fabrication shop were inside. Her dining room rivaled the finest restaurants. Her sick bay was more akin to an expensive hospital suite. Powered by a pair of magneto-hydrodynamic propulsion units, the ship could run like a cheetah and turn like a bumper car. The ship was nothing like her outside appearance indicated. The Oregon was an armed, high-tech intelligence platform staffed by highly trained people. The corporation, who owned and operated the Oregon, was comprised of ex-military and intelligence operatives who hired themselves out to countries and individuals needing specialized services. They were a private army of mercenaries with a conscience, often secretly tasked by the U.S. government to perform missions because they were outside the scope of congressional oversight. They existed in a shadowy world without diplomatic protection or governmental acknowledgement. The corporation was a force for hire, but they accepted clients carefully. For the past week, they had been in Iceland providing security for the Emir of Qatar, who was attending the summit. Iceland had been selected for the meetings for a variety of reasons. The country was small, Reykjavik's population was only around 100,000, and that helped with the security concerns. The population was homogeneous, and that made outsiders stand out like sore thumbs, which added to the ability to detect terrorists intent on disturbing the peace process. And lastly, Iceland claimed to have the world's oldest elected parliament. The country had been involved in the democratic process from centuries past. The agenda for the week-long meetings included the occupation of Iraq, the situation in Israel and Palestine, and the spread of fundamentalist terrorism. And while the summit was not sanctioned by the United Nations or any other world governing body, the leaders in attendance realized that policy would be formed and courses of action decided. Russia, France, Germany, Egypt, Jordan, and a host of other Middle Eastern countries were attending. Israel, Syria, and Iran had declined. The United States, Great Britain, and Poland, as the Allied liberators of Iraq, were there, as well as a host of smaller countries. Nearly 24 nations and their ambassadors, security, intelligence operatives, and handlers had descended on Iceland's capital city like a swarm of mosquitoes in the night. With the city's small population, the numerous spies and security people were as obvious to the citizens of Reykjavik as if they had been wearing bikinis in the freezing cold weather. Icelanders were fair of skin, blonde of hair, and blue-eyed, a hard combination to fake if you're trying to blend in with the locals. Reykjavik was a city of low buildings and brightly painted houses that stood out against the snow-covered terrain like ornaments on a Christmas tree. The tallest building, Hallgrímskirkja Church, was but a few stories high, and the plumes of steam from the geothermal springs in the area that warmed the houses and buildings gave the landscape a surreal appearance. The smell of hydrogen sulfide from the springs tainted the air with a slight rotten egg odor. Reykjavik was clustered around the year-round ice-free port that housed the fishing fleet, the mainstay of Iceland's economy. And in contrast to the country's name, the winter temperature in the city was actually milder than New York City's. The citizens of Iceland are both extremely healthy and seemingly happy. The happiness can be traced to a positive state of mind, the health to the abundance of local hot springs pools. The Arab summit meetings were taking place at the Hofoy, the large house now used for city functions that had also been the site of a 1986 meeting between Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan. Hofoy was less than a mile from where the Oregon was docked, a convenience that made security an easier affair. Qatar had used the corporation in the past, and they enjoyed a mutual relationship of high regard. Out of respect for the Christian participants of the summit, no meetings had been scheduled for Christmas Day, so below decks in the galley of the Oregon, a trio of chefs was putting the finishing touches on the coming feast. The main course was in the oven, 12 large turduckens. The turduckens were a treat to the crew. They were small deboned chickens, stuffed with cornmeal and sage stuffing, inserted into deboned ducks with a thinner layer of spice bread stuffing, which were then stuffed inside large deboned turkeys that had been lined with an oyster and chestnut stuffing. When the carcasses were carved, the slices would reveal a trio of meats. Relish trays were already on the tables, iced carrots, celery, scallions, radishes, and julienne zucchini. There were bowls of nuts, fruits, and cheese and crackers, trays of crab claws, raw oysters, and lobster chunks, three kinds of soup, Waldorf green and gelatin salads, a fish course, a cheese course, mince, pumpkin, apple, and berry pies, wine, port, liqueurs, and Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee. None of the crew would leave hungry. In his opulent stateroom, Juan Cabrillo toweled his wet hair, then shaved and splashed his cheeks with bay rum aftershave. His blonde crew cut required little maintenance, but in the last few weeks he'd grown a goatee, which he now carefully trimmed with a set of stainless steel scissors. Satisfied with his work, he stared in the mirror and smiled. He looked good, rested, healthy, and content. Walking into the main cabin, he selected a starched white shirt, a finely woven lightweight gray wool suit tailored in London, a silk rep tie, soft gray wool socks, and a pair of black polished Cole Haan tassel loafers. After laying them out, he began to dress. While knotting the red and blue striped tie, he did a last check, then opened the door and walked down the passageway toward the elevator. A few hours ago, his team had learned of a threat to the Emir. A plan was now in place that, if successful, would kill two birds with one stone. Now, if they could only locate the stray nuclear bomb that was missing halfway across the globe, the year could end on a positive note. Cabrillo had no way of knowing that within 24 hours he would be traveling across a frozen wasteland to the east, or that the fate of a city by a river would hang in the balance.